The economy was such a focus of the president's speech last night that we thought it was appropriate to check in with NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. Marilyn, thanks for coming in once again.
Hi.
Now, you just heard from senior White House advisor Valerie Jarrett. And the president said that, quote, the state of the union is getting stronger. But I think you heard Ms. Jarrett say that a lot more is yet to do. So where are we really?
Well, the state of the economy at this moment is actually pretty good, at least compared with where we've been. Now, I know if you're unemployed, it doesn't feel that way at all. But if you look at what happened in December, for example, 200,000 jobs were created. Last August, people were talking about the possibility of a double dip recession. They thought the economy was actually contracting. But now we're getting the data that shows in the fourth quarter, in the towards the end of the year, actually it was probably pretty good, better than 3%. So if you're looking at the economy at this very moment, corporations have a lot of cash on hand. That means they can add to hiring. We've got the unemployment rate is down from about 10% at the worst to 8.5%. Those are good things. And they say when you're an incumbent, the trend is your friend. So you want to not look at so much where have we been, but where are we headed. And if you look ahead, the economy seems to be on a fairly good path. But and that's a very big but, there are some really major uncertainties out there that could change that trajectory by November.
Well, let's talk about that. What are those things? What are the things that maybe just give me three things that economists are particularly
always,
worried about?
lots of things to worry about. But the big three right now, there are three foreign factors that are really weighing on economists' mind if they're going to break bad for us. Number one is the European debt crisis. That's a serious problem. Hasn't been solved, and it could get much, much worse, destabilizing financial markets around the world. Number two, oil prices. You know, people really relate to gasoline prices. It matters a lot to consumers, and understandably, that if gasoline is rising, that's a real problem for you. So it's also a problem if you're running for re-election. But we have a lot of tension in the Middle East. Iran is a situation that it could go bad at any moment. So that's a real threat. And then number three, China has been looking like it might be heading towards a recession. That would be bad for us. And then, well, there's a big, giant fourth factor, and that is a domestic problem and what's going to happen with Congress.
Well, I was going to ask, though, because the things that you enumerated, I mean, from the standpoint of being incumbents, I mean, both, you know, members of Congress and the president, there are obviously everybody in the House of Representatives, as Loretta Sanchez pointed out, are all running, and, of course, a significant third of the Senate. So they're all on the ballot. And none of those things that you talked about really have anything to do with anything they can control. Yeah. What about the things that they can control? I know that you went to a briefing of some key members of Congress. Was there any sense that they found any common ground with the president, or are there areas that they think they can work together?
Yes, this morning, National Journal and The Atlantic put on this program where some key members of Congress were invited to talk about what they see happening this year. And that's this fear that economists have that nothing will get done this year, that there will be this really serious gridlock that could trigger problems with the economy. And from what I heard this morning, there's good reason for those fears. For example, Congressman Paul Ryan, he's the head of the House Budget Committee, talked about his perception of President Obama's leadership and would he get anything done. And he literally said about President Obama, quote, he has shown nothing but demagoguery, end quote, on the issue of things like entitlement reform, Social Security.
And
he said that he could not work with this president, that all serious economic advances on issues like Social Security and Medicare would have to await a new president.
So does that reflect the feeling of the entire House leadership? I mean, he's the chair of the Budget Committee, which is certainly a key and influential role.
Well, that's what he seems to be.
Does that reflect the perspective of the leadership?
I would say that there seemed to be a feeling there. There was also Senator Barrasso, a Republican from Wyoming. He was talking about some of the smaller issues. Ryan was talking about this really big stuff, Social Security reform. But Barrasso was talking about the payroll tax holiday that we're going to have in January and February. The president wants to extend that for the full year. But Republicans have attached to that and the issue of this pipeline, an oil pipeline called the Keystone Pipeline.
That Valerie Jarrett was just talking about a minute ago, saying that the two have nothing to do with each other, so why are they related?
Well, Republicans feel that this is the payroll tax holiday. It has to do with helping the economy. They feel the pipeline has to do with helping the economy, and they want those issues linked. The president has made it very clear he does not want those linked. So listening to those kinds of comments, you do have a feeling that a real problem for the economy this year may be that effectively it's a dead year in terms of getting anything accomplished in Congress, and that could be problematic.
So, Marilyn G. Wex, before we let you go, the next big political event in the presidential race is the Republican primary in Florida on January 31st, and it's really hard to talk about Florida without talking about the housing crisis. And as we mentioned earlier, the president made a proposal to allow homeowners to refinance that he said would save, you know, significant dollars. I just wanted to – we don't know a lot about the plan to this point, but how significant an issue is housing as in the consciousness of the American people, as part of the economic recovery?
This is really a huge issue all over the country, certainly, but Florida has really been ground zero for this housing problem. The states that have been pummeled, Nevada, Arizona, California, Florida, they continue to really struggle with this problem. And as a result, their unemployment rate is higher. As I said, in the United States, unemployment is about 8.5%. In Florida, it's closer to 10%. In some places, in like in the Tampa area, it's above 10%. And if you talk to anybody down in Florida, they all say it's tied to housing. Until you really get at that problem of these foreclosures and the underwater factor, about 44% of the people in Florida who own a home, their house is worth less than they owe.
44%.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
So that weighs on voters' minds, and that's a swing state. It's going to be an issue in this election.
Marilyn G. Wex is NPR senior business editor. She was nice enough to join us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Marilyn, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Coming up, the ladies head into the beauty shop to give their take on the president's State of the Union address. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels wasn't the only response. The Tea Party chose former GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain to weigh in.
We the people are coming. That's the Tea Party message to Washington, the president, and his administration. We the people are coming.
Politics and more in the beauty shop. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Microsoft is facing criticism for a new app it has patented for GPS services. It has been dubbed the Avoid Ghetto feature. The technology is meant for pedestrians to help them avoid bad weather, difficult terrain, and what the patent describes as an unsafe neighborhood. As we hear from NPR's Allison Keyes, critics consider the feature nothing short of racist, while others insist it's simply the next step in GPS technology.
Let's be clear. The word ghetto doesn't appear anywhere in the patent. It's called pedestrian route production. Microsoft declined any comment. The technology in the patent will take information from maps, weather information, crime statistics, and demographics, then create directions, quote, taking the user through neighborhoods with violent crime statistics below a certain threshold. But a slew of headlines included the incendiary Avoid Ghetto nickname and generated some outrage.
I was pretty appalled.
Sarah Chin is author of Technology and the Logic of American Racism and an English professor at Hunter College. Chin says she understands why people might want such a GPS feature so they'd feel safe, but she says it reinforces assumptions about violent crime that aren't true. Chin says the nickname the patent has picked up and the news coverage of the technology illustrate the assumption that it will steer you away from neighborhoods where blacks and Latinos live because those are bad neighborhoods.
Even that immediate association is itself a symptom of the problem.
Chin says that storyline is so embedded in American society that people make what she calls that jump without even having to explain it.
Which is to say, we as white middle class readers will immediately understand, you know, what this is all about.
Chin says we need to be able to distinguish between our prejudices and our assumptions and what's actually true. Though FBI crime stats for 2010 show that whites were arrested more often for violent crimes than any other race, Chin says,
in much of dominant American culture, there's an assumption that criminality and being poor and not white go hand in hand.
On the internet, there have been bitter battles, with written comments urging people to, quote, just stay out of Black and Hispanic neighborhoods, or others describing as racist people who, quote, naturally associate avoiding crime with avoiding Blacks. Of course, some folk, including Loop21.com editor Maurice Garland, poked a little fun at the controversy.
I mentioned Flint, Michigan.
Garland posted a piece on the African-American website listing places he felt would likely show up as unsafe on the software. Flint had the highest crime rate in current city crime rankings by the CQ Press.
I wouldn't be surprised if the entire city of Flint got a big red dot on the avoid ghetto application.
Garland says many of those offended by his posting about the technology were people of color, but he personally thinks the feature is more classist than racist.
I don't think anybody from any particular race was just being singled out. I mean, because they are using crime data to come up with these figures. So, I mean, you know, if you don't want to end up in those places, I mean, I don't see anything wrong with somebody trying to help you out.
I think it's something that the users of the technology have been asking for some time.
Industry analyst Rob Enderle says the GPS feature in the patent has nothing to do with race or income. He says it's about technology doing for us what it's supposed to be doing.
It's part of an overall effort to make navigation systems more intelligent so they keep you out of danger, whether you're driving or you're on foot.
In England 2 years ago, Jeff Gilfelt created a similar app that also uses government data. He says what's important is how software is developed and the quality of data it uses.
If it's taking data about, you know, incidents of crime that are, you know, directly impact public safety, there should be no racial or economic or class bias there.
Gilfelt says his app didn't generate the level of controversy the Microsoft patent has. But there is an app that was created as an answer to his. It's called the Awesome Meter, and its description says it gives hope and security rather than spreading fear and distrust. Allison Keyes, NPR News, Washington.
Our program is directed by Monica Evstatieva, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. We had engineering support from Melissa Marquis.
Our planning editors are Jerry Holmes and Julia Buckley. The staff includes Graham Smith, Franklin Cater, Janae West, Gabe O'Connor, Carol Klinger, Viet Le, Jennifer Longmire-Wright, and Rhonda Ray.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. The managing editor for NPR News is David Sweeney. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Google is revamping its privacy policies, and privacy advocates are not happy about it. The changes will allow Google to track its registered users across the web. NPR's Steve Hannon reports.
Google executives say they're making these changes for simplicity's sake. Taken together, Google sites and services have more than 70 separate privacy policies. There's one for search, one for YouTube, another for Gmail. But starting March 1st, most of these will be rolled into one. And in most cases, information collected by one part of the company will be shared throughout Google's online empire. That means if you Google Prozac, you might see an ad for Zoloft the next time you're on YouTube.
The number one prescribed brand of its kind, Zoloft. When you know more about what's wrong, you can help make it right.
Or a link could pop up in Gmail. Jeffrey Chester at the Center for Digital Democracy says Google is in a fierce battle to give online advertisers exactly what they want.
Increasingly, online advertisers want to be assured that they can access users online knowing everything possible about them.
Google's rival in this space is Facebook. And this week, Facebook's rolling out dozens of new apps to make sharing easier. Apps that will automatically post to your Facebook page what you're doing online or even in the real world. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg calls it frictionless sharing.
You don't have to like a book. You can just read a book, which is good because you've probably read about 10 times more books than you'd want to like on Facebook anyway.
For advertisers, this is a boon. But for all these new Facebook apps to work, you have to opt in first. What Google's doing is a bit different. It's taking existing services, services you may already use, like Gmail, and changing what it does with the information it collects on them.
I think the danger for Google is that people may be surprised and may be creeped out by just how much the company seems to know about them.
Ryan Kahlo directs privacy studies at Stanford's Center for Internet and Society. He says there's legitimate reason to be concerned, but there's also a chance that Google will use all this data it collects to create new, better products. And that's exactly what Alan Eustace, a VP at Google, says the company's hoping to do.
An example might be a calendar. We'll say I have a meeting in San Francisco, and another product will, you know, look at the maps and the traffic situation and say, hey, you know, if you want to leave at this time, you know, you'll actually make it, but this time you won't.
Eustace says that's only possible if different Google products can share the information they collect with each other. Of course, that makes selling ads easier too.
Absolutely.
And selling ads is, after all, the business that Google is in. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The school taco is getting a makeover. Today, the USDA released new school lunch standards. They trim salt, sugar, and portion sizes to make lunch healthier. First Lady Michelle Obama was on hand at an elementary school in Alexandria, Virginia, for a taste test. NPR's Allison Aubrey has the story.
As the First Lady slid her tray down the lunch line with a bunch of students at Park Lawn Elementary, she scooped up the brown rice turkey tacos, served with fresh salsa on whole grain flatbread.
This is so nice. It's so well prepared. Oh, I love it.
And she says this is what a meal is supposed to look like. Lots of color, lots of taste, but lighter on fat, calories, and salt. Talking to parents who'd gathered at the school, the First Lady says these new standards, which also mandate 2 servings of veggies per meal, aren't only about combating obesity. They're also about helping kids stay sharp mentally in the classroom, avoiding those mid-afternoon sugar crashes. And hopefully, she says, the standards will help reinforce the messages lots of moms and dads have been trying to drill into kids' heads about good nutrition.
When we send our kids to school, we have a right to expect that they won't be eating the kind of fatty, salty, sugary foods that we're trying to keep from them when they're at home.
More than 32 million kids participate in school meal programs every day, and advocates who've been pushing for healthier meals say this is progress, though the rules are not as aggressive as the Obama administration had hoped for. Margot Wu-Tan directs nutrition efforts at the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
It's a huge step forward. These new school meal standards will mean much healthier foods on our kids' lunch trays.
Even though the trays will continue to carry servings of French fries and pizza, Wu-Tan says the U.S. Department of Agriculture was not able to finalize a provision that would have restricted servings of French fries, nor were they able to cancel out a rule that allows schools to count pizza as a vegetable. On these issues, she says Congress and powerful food lobbyists prevailed.
Under the new standards, even though USDA wasn't able to do what they wanted to do around limiting French fries and not counting pizza as a vegetable anymore, there still will be healthier pizza in the school lunch.
It'll have a whole grain crust, be lower in sodium and fat, and it will need to be served with another vegetable. The USDA estimates that the price tag for new nutrition standards will total about $3.2 billion over the next 5 years, with many of the changes being phased in gradually. But Diane Pratt-Hevner of the School Nutrition Association says school food directors are already trying creative ways to win students over on healthier eating.
We're seeing more schools with salad bars and student taste tests and Harvest of the Month programs that they're really trying to encourage kids to expand their palates and try fruits and vegetables that they might not have encountered at home.
As for mom Alyssa Simmons, who attended the First Lady's announcement today, she says these new lunches, especially the 2 servings of vegetables, will be better than what she usually manages to pack for her son.
We're always so pressed for time. You just throw here and there, you figure one is good enough.
So Simmons says from now on, her son will be eating the school lunch. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.